Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Audible is the home of storytelling, and it lets you enjoy all of your audio entertainment in one app. You'll always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. In fact, I've been really into thrillers and true crime lately, and I just got back from a long car trip where I was listening to the latest zombie Fallout book, Bridging the Gap. And I swear, I had to keep checking the back seat for any glowing eyes as I drove home on that deserted highway. In fact, on so many of my journeys, Audible is there for me, with comedy, bestsellers, history, exclusive originals, and more. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. That's audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. We've all been there. Maybe we used one or two misleading words in a shared document, and then the whole team spends a lot of wasted time trying to get on the same page. But we don't need to make those mistakes. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all of the wasted time and money that goes with it. I spend a lot of time writing. I write scripts, emails, speeches, proposals, you name it. And Grammarly helps me find the right tone. It does so much more than correct grammar. It's almost like a trusted writing partner. And when every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. Teams that communicate better with Grammarly report 52% less time spent writing sales emails and 66% less time spent editing marketing content. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Hey, everyone. Want to grow your business faster and stronger? Wondering how to find and keep top talent? Well, it starts with your company culture. Your company's identity and operations depend on the culture you create. Fortunately, there's Insperity, a leading HR provider. Their specialists show you how to build a culture aligned with your business goals, driving success. Download their free ebook, The Future of Business is Culture, at Insperity.com for ways to create a culture that fuels growth. With the right people, processes, and values in place, your company can realize its full potential. Visit Insperity.com to see how Insperity provides HR that makes a difference.
So we're scaling up, and we're also realizing that the product now in 2011 is just not working. It's just not working. And at this point, there are competitors coming out that are launching mobile first, mobile only, and we've been on the web. I mean, honestly, it's like the entire consumer market and expectation just changed underneath us, and we missed it.
Welcome to How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how a hungry 100-pound dog on a snowy night inspired Leah Sullivan to launch TaskRabbit, a service that will take care of your errands. Leah Sullivan's idea for a business grew out of a very specific problem she wanted to solve on one snowy evening in Boston. The problem of getting a big bag of dog food for her yellow lab to her apartment. And did she really want to go out in the middle of a snowstorm? Not really. But was there someone else who might be willing to do it for the right price? Now, that was an interesting question. But the thing Leah found most compelling about this problem was not that the solution might one day turn into a business. Instead, Leah, who at the time was an engineer at IBM, saw the problem as more of an engineering challenge. Like, do I have the coding skills I need to solve the dog food delivery problem? And if, for example, I were to start an online business for home deliveries, is the market ready for that to happen? Well, the answer to these questions turned out to be a resounding yes. Because not only did Leah know how to code, she also knew how to connect the dots. And at that time, in 2008, she was connecting three very important dots in particular. Three technologies that were about to intersect in a critical way. Mobile, location services, and social media. Those three developments would, of course, eventually power companies like Lyft and Uber and Airbnb and Instacart and DoorDash. But as early as 2008, even before any of those companies came on the scene, Leah was coding the beginnings of what would become TaskRabbit. It's a marketplace that matches users with freelancers who provide all types of services, from delivery to furniture building to gardening. Working out of a Boston coffee shop, Leah found a group of moms to be her first users, and she recruited people from Craigslist to be the first errand runners. And over the next few years, as the company grew, it also navigated a series of hairpin turns, including some management shakeups and at least one major rebranding that was hated by many of its loyal users. But TaskRabbit continued to grow, and 9 years after launch, it sold to IKEA for an undisclosed amount, and Leah moved on, having created one of the best-known mobile marketplaces in the country. Leah grew up in a little town outside of Boston. Her dad ran training programs at a nearby Air Force base while her mom looked after the family. As a young girl, Leah was really into dance, but when she got to college at Sweetbriar in Virginia, she took her first programming courses and got hooked on C++.
For me, it was the opportunity to be able to build whatever was in my mind. I mean, I am very imaginative. I have ideas all the time. And I'm not really good at delegation. And so the idea that I could take what was in my head and build it so that someone else could see it or use it or interact with it was really exciting. I mean, I remember it was the simplest assignment, which was taking this little JPEG robot and being able to code it so that with the arrow keys on the keyboard, it could move around the screen. And honestly, that was enough for me to understand how powerful programming and engineering could be.
Yeah. All right. So you fall in love with programming, C++. And this was your first exposure. Like, you weren't like a kid who had, like, you know, the Apple II at home and then like a PC clone and you were using BASIC and you were like, I don't know, reading computer magazines in high school?
Yeah, no, well, so not really, but a little bit. Let me explain. So, you know, programming in college was my first exposure to actual engineering. In high school, I dated someone who eventually became my husband, who I started TaskRabbit with, Kevin. And Kevin was really into computers.
Right.
And so we would spend, like, Friday nights, I would help him build computers.
Oh,
we would
wow.
go to computer shows on the week. Yeah.
So you were plugging in the components into the
yes,
slots
the
and
motherboard
stuff.
Yeah. Oh, and yeah. the bus driver.
I've done that once,
and like
twice, actually. Yeah. It's fun.
Twice. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it is fun. We go to computer shows and buy parts, and that was very helpful.
Yeah. All right. So 2001, I believe you graduate from Sweetbriar with a degree in computer science. And I think you get a job as an engineer at a small software startup, which I guess eventually gets merged into IBM. And what are you doing for them? What were you coding?
I actually started as a quality engineer, so I wasn't doing any programming. They wouldn't let me touch the code, but I was the tester. So I would find all the bugs in the code, I would write up the bugs, and then I'd work with the developers and the engineers to fix them. I did that for 5 years, but I always wanted to be the programmer. I always wanted to be the coder. It was really hard for me to break into that side, though. You know, and I saw other IBM, you know, interns coming in right out of school and joining as engineers. And I'm like, why aren't I coding? Why aren't
yeah.
I programming?
Because you knew how to do it.
But yeah. I did. I finally worked my way into it. And the only way that was possible is I got another job offer
nice.
At another
Always
startup
the case.
To be a programmer.
Story of my life.
I know. So I was like, I can do this. I can go do it at this other company, or I can stay here and do it.
And they're like,
so,
no, don't go.
Exactly. Oh, we really value you. Don't go.
Yep.
And so finally, I get to start coding and I joined a new team. And I really loved that team in my time there. I still stay in touch with my mentors and technical leads there on that team.
Meanwhile, you got married really early, like right out of college, to your sort of high school sweetheart, right? Kevin.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I was 22.
Wow.
He actually also worked at Iris Associates, which was bought by Lotus, and then Lotus was bought by IBM. And okay. So we worked together there for many years. And then he left first. He left and started joining startups in the Boston area, focused mostly in the healthcare space. And I stayed.
Right. And it was a stable job. I mean, you had probably had health insurance. I'm sure you did. You had health insurance and a retirement plan. I mean, it's IBM's the mothership, right? And
yes.
So you were there for like, I think something like seven years or six years, right?
Almost eight years.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It was consistently one of the top 100 places to work for women. And that mattered to me.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can just stay here. I can move up. I always wanted to stay on the technical side. They kept trying to put me in management, go manage people. I was like, I don't want to manage anyone. But by the end, the last couple years, I felt a little bit loose in the saddle. I know for a fact that I was seen as very ambitious. And in fact, there was one incident that occurred on my team where, you know, one of the other engineers said to me, wow, Leah, you're really ambitious. And he said it like it was a problem.
Like they're criticizing you for being ambitious.
And I was super confused. His tone, like, it didn't make sense to me. Exactly.
Yeah.
But you know what? That actually was part of what made me realize that IBM wasn't the long-term fit for me.
Yeah.
And I was really ambitious. And I did always have this sort of fire in my belly.
Yeah.
And so I think people saw that. People knew that. I mean, that's hard for me to hide.
I guess we should also clarify. It probably wasn't even IBM. It was just a big company with a bureaucracy that wasn't going to it couldn't accommodate your ambitions, right? You had to do something and it wasn't going to happen at a big company.
That's right. And I think in hindsight, what I've realized, just a pattern in my career, a pattern in my life is, and really, I mean, back into college too, I only like to work on problems that I feel like I can uniquely solve.
Yeah.
And if I feel like there's someone else who can also do it and do it just as well, like, I become very disengaged and very bored.
Yeah.
And uninterested in working on it. And so I think that was where the ambition came from. And I was always thinking, like, I can do more. I want to be doing more.
All right. So you start to get itchy feet, right? You're starting to think, okay,
yes.
I'm just getting bored here. And you're, you know, in your late 20s, right? And what's going through your mind? Do you start to think, like, maybe I could do something on my own? Maybe, I mean, were you searching for something or were you just, what do you remember about that time around 2007, 2008?
Yeah. So at that point, we were living in Charlestown, a neighborhood of Boston. I was working out of the Cambridge office for IBM. And I did start to think, you know what? I have the skill set. I have ideas. Like, maybe I should just go code some things. And I started a blog, mostly about technical engineering projects, ideas. There was one idea I had in the real estate space where I was, you know, doing these going to open houses and doing write-ups about them and then letting, you know, buyers engage with the blog entry.
Oh, wow. Oh, you would write a review of the house? Like, this house sucks, don't bother?
Yes.
That would save a lot of time.
Yes. And it was anonymous, right? It was all anonymous. No one knew it was me.
Terrible staging. Don't go to this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really, it was really fun. I mean, I've since now invested in a company that
does a version
sort
of
doing, is doing a version of this. It's very exciting. But yeah, that was back in 2006, 2007. And so I also built a dog walking site for our dog walker so that he could expand his business. And then I started building dog walking sites for all of his dog walking friends. And then I had the idea for what became TaskRabbit.
So tell me how that happened. I mean, how did the TaskRabbit, what would become TaskRabbit, how did that idea first come to you?
Yeah. So I was in this very entrepreneurial mindset. I was looking for a problem to solve. And so it was February of 2008. It was cold and snowing outside. We're getting ready to go out to dinner in Boston with some friends. And we realized we were out of dog food. And at the time, we had this 100-pound yellow lab named Kobe, who we kept very well fed.
100 pounds?
Yeah,
That's a human. That's not a dog.
He was a big guy. He was a big guy.
It's another human in your house.
He was the best. And so we realized we're out of this dog food, and I'm talking with Kevin, and I'm like, God, there's got to be a way to get this dog food. We're taking a cab to dinner. We don't want to drag the dog food with us to dinner.
Talking about a 30-pound bag of dog food.
Yeah, a big bag of dog food. Yeah. That's right. What if all the stores are closed on the way home? It's snowing outside. And I was like, you know what? Wouldn't it be nice if there's just a place online you could go, say you needed dog food, name the price you're willing to pay. There's probably someone in our neighborhood right now that'd be willing to help us out. And maybe there's even someone at the store at this very second, and we should be able to connect with them.
Yeah.
And the iPhone had just come out. And so I grabbed my iPhone and I was like, we should be able to connect with who's ever at the store right now. I said, okay, if a site like this existed, what would it be called? And I typed into my iPhone, into GoDaddy, runmyerrand.com. Mm-hmm. And the domain name was available for $6.99.
Great.
So I bought it on the spot. And I was like, okay, well, we now own runmyerrand.com. What are we going to do with it? And so we ended up going to dinner. We met friends at dinner. Like, it was that dinner where we're talking about this idea with friends.
You start talking about this idea. And let's say I was at dinner with you. I would have said to you at the time, because I'm like a buzzkill. Not anymore, but I would have been then. Would have said, but no, I might still say to you. I say, but what about Peapod? That's around. Peapod exists. I know it existed in Boston in 2008. You could get Peapod to deliver food to your house.
That's right. There's also a grocery company, I think Home Run or something like that. And
that was around,
Cosmo.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, Cosmo had just like flamed out. All kinds of, you know, sort of dead companies in this space.
But before you got that discouraging news,
yes,
at that dinner, your friends were like, oh my God, this is amazing, Leah. You should do this. This is incredible. Was it like that kind of dinner?
Yeah, it was, but they weren't in tech either. So they were doctors. My friend, it was like a Sweetbriar College roommate who was going to medical school. I mean, they were kind of like, huh, that's interesting, you know?
And it sounds interesting. Like I might have also said at the time, you know, I would totally use that. Yeah, I hate going out in the snow and... This is before Uber. This is before that we now have come to depend on, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective. But
yes,
I might have said to you, yeah, I would totally, if somebody could just like bring it to my house and I could just go online and.
Absolutely. Yes. It was, people were excited. It made sense. They were like, hold on, someone must be doing this. Like this already exists. Yeah. I mean, it was a lot of like, this must exist already. But I think the key, like I knew as an engineer that no one was using mobile yet technologies.
Right.
The App Store was just emerging. It was very early.
Yep.
I knew no one was using location-based awareness. And so as an engineer, again, I was like, I want to find the person at the store at this moment. How do I find that person?
Yeah.
And then the other key for me from a technical standpoint was Facebook was just emerging and coming out of the college scene.
Yeah.
And honestly, the biggest piece of feedback we got in the early days, including at this dinner, was why would I trust a stranger to bring something to me or to come into my house? You know, what if they're, you know, an axe murderer? I mean, people would say this to me all the time.
Yeah.
And so I saw Facebook as a way to leverage the social graph to build trust between people. So if I could tell you that, you know, you need your dry cleaning picked up and the person that was going to pick up your dry cleaning was 2 degrees of separation from you and your friend Bob, like you're going to be okay with that.
But initially the idea was to just have people run errands for you. It wasn't like to come and fix things in your house. It was just like, go get your dry cleaning, go get your groceries, right? Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And deliver food or whatever it might be.
Yep.
And you had all of these, I mean, you had this kind of unfair advantage because of your background as an engineer. Like you Did you understand intuitively how you could do this? Like, how, did you understand that the technology existed to make this possible?
I did, and that was the key driver for me. I think as an engineer and as someone who wanted to work on something, I saw those three technologies, social, location, and mobile, and that was what was interesting to me at the time. I was like, I can mash up these three technologies and create a new platform that no one has launched before.
It is amazing because it is a very simple concept. It's have somebody deliver something to you. But the challenge was a technology challenge. It wasn't a...
Yeah.
I mean, the idea was simple. You weren't coming up with... people have been delivering stuff for centuries. How do you connect the person to the person who needs the service? That was what you had to solve.
Yes. And I've always said, I am not the first person who had the idea for TaskRabbit. Many people have had this idea. Many, many people. But it was the way that I leveraged the technology that was available at the time that made it all work.
By the way, same story with Google and Facebook. They did not invent those technologies. They just made them better.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
And that's the cycle of innovation. I mean, just building sort of on the backs of what has come before you.
Yeah. Okay. So now, from what I understand, you're working at IBM and you're still employed there. You're not going to leave your job. But this idea stays in your mind, so much so that you really start to do the kinds of things that I think really smart entrepreneurs do, which is you first start to research it. You first start to kind of... You talk to people, you try to understand whether this is possible and viable.
Yes.
But you reached out.
The first person that was sort of pivotal that I reached out to was Scott Griffith, who was running Zipcar.
Wow. And Zipcar was really started to take off in 2008. I remember using it back then. I would just get my card and,
Absolutely. It was taking off. And he had taken over from the founders, from Rob and Chase. Mm-hmm. And it was in Cambridge. And I met Scott through a friend of a friend. I mean, it wasn't an obvious connection. But again, we had been out to dinner one night with friends and talking about this idea. And my friend says, oh my gosh, you know who you should talk to? My friend Scott. He would love this idea. I used to work with him back at my old company. I had no idea he was the CEO of Zipcar. She failed to mention this.
Yeah.
And I email Scott this note. I'm like, hi, Scott, my name is Leah, and I'm working on this new idea. And to his credit, he wrote me back Sunday morning, and he was like, wow, this sounds interesting. Why don't you come by my office this week? And then I see in his signature that he's the CEO.
Of Zipcar.
Of Zipcar. And I lose my breath. I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe I just emailed the CEO of Zipcar. Cold email.
So, all right. So, and when you told him the idea... How did you describe it?
So I went to his office and I said, much like you're thinking about Zipcar, where you share cars in a neighborhood, I want to create a platform in a marketplace where you can share errands and share services. And he immediately was like, wow, I think you're onto something here. Let's meet again next week. And so he just was so brilliant and so nice. And he said, why don't you come by every week for an hour and sit with me and we can brainstorm? I was still at IBM.
Yeah.
And so I started meeting up with Scott once a week. I go by the office, tell him more about the idea. I talk to him about challenges I saw in the marketplace. He would tell me about Zipcar as well and his experiences there.
Yeah.
And finally, after a few months of that, he said to me, Leah, I really feel like you're onto something here. Why don't you just see how far you can take it? And it was sort of his nice way of saying, like, what are you still doing at IBM?
When we come back in just a moment, Halea taps into Craigslist and her local coffee shop to launch Run My Errand, just in time for the onset of the global financial crisis. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This. Here on our show, we bring you tales of the long, sometimes really hard road to building a successful company. Of course, no two entrepreneurs' journeys are exactly the same, but themes do emerge, One, there's no way they can do it alone. Another is how incredibly important it is for companies to keep their teams connected, no matter where they are in the world. Our sponsor, Atlassian, knows this better than anyone. Their team has spent over 20 years creating software like Jira and Confluence to make collaboration of any size and across any distance possible, because Atlassian believes the best ideas are impossible alone. And look, there will always be challenges with distributed work. Our team here at How I Built This might not be huge. We do a lot with a small group of hardworking people, but we really understand the importance of staying organized and having visibility across the team, especially when we're all working remotely. Having the right collaboration products can make all the difference when you need to move quickly, work efficiently, and make informed decisions. With their evidence-based approach, Atlassian has redefined collaboration for teams scattered across the globe. And if you're looking for solutions for your team, Atlassian's suite of software is the foundation to help make the way you work that much more seamless. No matter where you are, your team can plan meticulously with Jira and create a knowledge base with Confluence, turning ideas into action and brainstorming into breakthroughs. A world where distributed teams sync effortlessly, where the touch of innovation streamlines every project, that's not a dream. It's a reality with Atlassian. Whether your team is spread across the country or even the globe, delivering greatness is impossible alone. Learn more at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now, picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Don't just talk about improving. Masterclass helps you actually do it. There are over 200 classes to pick from, like Anna Wintour's Masterclass on Creativity and Leadership that's helped lots of people learn new ways to nurture talent and make bold decisions, two things that are essential for any leader or entrepreneur. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/built. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/built. Masterclass.com/built. We've all been there. Maybe we used one or two misleading words in a shared document, and then the whole team spends a lot of wasted time trying to get on the same page. But we don't need to make those mistakes. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all of the wasted time and money that goes with it. I spend a lot of time writing. I write scripts, emails, speeches, proposals, you name it. And Grammarly helps me find the right tone. It does so much more than correct grammar. It's almost like a trusted writing partner. And when every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. Teams that communicate better with Grammarly report 52% less time spent writing sales emails and 66% less time spent editing marketing content. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's 2008, and Leah is still working full-time at IBM. But in her spare time, on nights and weekends, she's thinking about how to get Run My Errand on its feet, and she's workshopping her business plan every chance she gets.
I would sit next to someone on the bus going into Boston. I'd be like, hey, do you want to hear about this new idea? I mean, I would talk to anyone who would listen to me.
Yeah.
But one of the places where I got a lot of great feedback was a little coffee shop in Charlestown called Zoomies. And I'd go hang out there, and I would code and I'd program, and there were a bunch of moms that would come into the coffee shop with their kids. And I'd say, like, hey, do you have a second? I'm working on this new thing. Like, would you use a service like this? How much would you pay? What sorts of jobs do you need help with? What do you need done? The owners of the coffee shop were so fabulous. They were very nice to let me hang out there, you know, for hours and hours and talk to their customers.
Using their Wi-Fi.
Using their Wi-Fi eating their muffins. It was all good.
Yeah. Yeah. Spending $7 for 4 hours right. of Wi-Fi.
Yes. And so in Charlestown, this 1 square mile neighborhood of Boston, I figured out that there was this Mother's Association. And I'm not a mom at the time, right? I'm still like, I don't have kids. So I don't fully understand. But I think moms are busy and like they'd probably use the service. So I go to the head of the Charlestown Mothers Organization and I say, okay, I have this idea. I've talked to a lot of the moms in town and I want to build a beta for you. I want to build a beta just for you, 900 moms in 1 square mile of Boston. You know, will you advertise it through your newsletter if I build you this beta?
Right. Okay. I understand that part.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yep.
I'm wondering how you're going to do the other part, which is to find the people to do the task.
Oh, that was easy. I just went to Craigslist.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. So I build the site for the moms, closed beta, and I post an ad on Craigslist. And I say, I'm looking for some help running errands. And I get hundreds of inquiries. I'll help you, you know. And so I'm like, wow, okay, there's a lot of demand out there for people that want to run errands.
Brilliant.
And
yeah.
So I started meeting potential, at the time we called them runners because it was runmyerrand.com.
They would come meet you face to face.
Yeah, I met everyone face to face to start because I was terrified that, you know, there was going to be a trust and safety issue early on.
Yeah.
And so I met them all at Zumi's coffee shop, 30-minute interviews, and I brought on 30 of them to start the site.
Yeah. You know, I'm just curious, just it's a bit of an aside, but this is the time when Uber and Lyft and, you know, Airbnb are really kind of starting to come together. Still not known yet, not widely used yet.
Right.
What would become known as like the gig economy or peer-to-peer economy. Did you even know about that? Were you kind of looking around and saying, you know, this is going to be a thing?
Not yet. That was still so early. It was so early.
Yeah.
I mean, Uber hadn't started yet. Yeah. Relay Rides was started in Boston. And that was kind of like a Zipcar, but with people that owned their cars, right? Now it's Turo.
But you weren't like looking at the landscape and saying this peer-to-peer economy is going to be, because it's amazing that you were already thinking like this. I mean, who knew that it was going to become a huge thing?
It was the engineer in me. I was really driven by the technology.
Yeah.
That was it. I had no exposure still to Silicon Valley or what was happening. You know, like I didn't really know what was going on the West Coast. And so I was driven by the technology and what I saw what was possible with the technology.
All right. So you land like 30 people to be errand runners and you've got this group of moms.
Yes.
And then what? Then what? How did you get them to like? Because it's a chicken and egg problem, right? You need the you need the problem and you need the solver. You need the solver. You need the problem. So,
that's
how
right.
did you get them to to start?
Yeah. So I posted in the Charlestown Mothers Association newsletter that runmyerrand.com was open to them and them alone.
Yeah.
And that I had vetted, you know, these 30 taskers or runners at the time.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I posted, you know, some moms were trying it out. They needed dry cleaning picked up. They need groceries delivered.
Yeah.
You know, just like simple, easy little tasks. I then had created the algorithm, right, which would alert all of the runners, all of the taskers at the time, that a new job had been posted. So they'd get an alert on their phone. And at that time, it was a bidding system. Runners at the time would pick up jobs. They would do the errands. They would be rated and reviewed by the customer. But I personally, right, would get an alert every time something was posted. I mean, this was a closed beta. I would be sweating bullets to see how long it would take for a runner, for a tasker to pick up the job. I was like, oh my God, is someone going to pick this up? I mean, like, I didn't know. It was a marketplace. It was someone would pick it up or they wouldn't pick it up. I ended up being the one doing a lot of the early jobs. I had this little scooter that I rode around Boston, a Charlestown area, and I would do a lot of the early jobs myself. And so I would then get like firsthand knowledge of what it was like to be a tasker, a runner, to do these jobs. And that actually helped a lot in building out the service, having that knowledge.
All right. Now, this is a lot of work. There's a lot going on here. But at what point Did you have to leave your day job? Because, you know, I don't think you left your day job until June of 2008.
Yeah.
Were you just like going to work during the day and then just trying to do all this stuff at night?
Yes. Nights, weekends. I mean, it was a lot. And it really was Scott who kind of nudged me to make the leap. He saw the progress.
Yeah.
And everyone I had talked to, no one had said, "You're insane. This won't work." Everyone's reaction
was, "This is a brilliant idea."
Yes. Everyone. Yeah. Everyone. And so I finally decided to make the leap and quit IBM.
Did you have savings, some money that you saved up?
So I had $27,000 in my IBM pension program that, you know, we could withdraw with a penalty It was for retirement. But I was like, whatever, let's just withdraw this money. And so I gave myself like 6 months to make something happen.
And meantime, I mean, I guess because you were married, Kevin probably had some income coming in. So you didn't have to worry about like feeding yourself.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. It's interesting because you said in the beginning, you had the stability of IBM. I was the stable one for many years while Kevin kind of jumped around at different startups. And we talked and he's like, you know what? This is such a great idea. I'll be the stable one. You go. Like, go see what you can do with this.
Yeah. So what would the user experience be like in 2008? You know, you'd go on. You had people who were available to run errands.
Yep.
And then what would you do as the person who needed an errand taken care of?
So I built it modeled after eBay, you know, the big marketplace at the time.
Yep.
And so you'd go on and you'd say, "I need dry cleaning picked up. I'm willing to pay you $10 to do it."
Okay.
And a tasker would come on. They'd get an alert on their phone and they'd say, "Will I do this for $10 or do I want to make a bid on the job?" "Oh, I'll do it for $15." So some runners, taskers, errand runners, they would bid on jobs. Yeah. Others would just do the buy now price, right? And connect. And then that was it. And then the transaction would occur offline, and then they'd come back to leave each other ratings and reviews.
Okay, so it's June of 2008. You've got some of these moms that you're working with. Mm-hmm. You're starting to onboard some errand runners in the beta.
Yes.
And how does it go?
It goes really well. And the moms in Charlestown start referring their moms in other neighborhoods of Boston, but it's not open in those neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, wow, maybe I should just open this up in more neighborhoods, but that means I need to go recruit more runners in these neighborhoods. But I'm then frantically posting Craigslist ads and interviewing runners all over the city. But it's going well. And I get to the point where I think, okay, maybe I should try to do a little bit of marketing or, you know, get the word out more than just word of mouth.
Yeah.
So I march into the Charlestown Patriot Bridge, which is the local newspaper in Charlestown.
Yeah.
And I pitched the guy there the story about Run My Errands starting and how I'm opening it up. It's been in the Charlestown Mothers Association. It's gone really well. And he's so nice and he loves the story. And he's like, let's write it up. I'll publish it.
Wow.
And honestly, that drove so much traffic. I mean, I think the readership was like 13,000 people. It drove so much traffic to the site and all over Boston. It wasn't just Charlestown. And so I was like, okay, wow, there's something here.
Yeah. I think you opened it up wide, right? The beta phase ended in like September of 2008, right? Something like that.
Yes, that's right. In September,
But September 2008 was, wow. I mean, that was like Lehman Brothers and you know, it was just the world is collapsing. And then you had like the Madoff Ponzi scheme was exposed in December, and then just the financial crisis in 2009. I actually remember it very well because I was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the fall of 2008.
Wow. Okay.
For a year. And that was a crazy time. Crazy time. It was like, do you remember having any anxiety over like, oh, I left my job and I'm starting that? Yeah.
Yes, I was freaking out. I was like, what am I doing? I had this stable job at IBM and the world feels like it's falling apart. Yeah, no one wants to give me money right now. Investors don't want to write checks right now. It was very stressful. But I did realize something, which was the runners, the taskers, the people that wanted to make money on the platform, it was overwhelming.
Because people were losing jobs?
Yes.
Wow.
It was overwhelming. Wow. And the skill sets and the talent in these people were educated and they'd gone to college. They were pharmacists. They were lawyers. They were teachers. They were being laid off.
Wow.
And they were looking for new ways to make money.
So you were getting overwhelmed with people who were responding to the Craigslist ad.
Yes. And so that motivated me that despite my own personal panic around leaving my own job to do this, that there was something interesting here to be built.
Yeah. But from what I've read, like in order to attract more users, right, to run My Errand, you tried a bunch of different interesting strategies. Like, for example, you offered like the first errand would be free. And so I'm assuming you guys would pay the errand runner. So you were losing money on it, but you had to attract users. So you
yes.
So that and then like you were trying to talk to, I guess, corporations like IBM. I think you even approached IBM to see
yes.
if they would adopt your service, right?
Yes. We tried everything. A lot of what I would call guerrilla marketing techniques. I mean, one of my actual favorite sort of stunts we did in Boston was to do a marketing program during the Boston Marathon, and we called it Run My Marathon. And we actually hired runners, errand runners, to run portions of the marathon all the way along the marathon route. But yeah, I mean, we just, it was boots on the ground, knocking on doors,
yeah.
You know, cold talking to these business owners about the service.
Meantime, you can't run this without any money, right? So
right.
I from what I understand, you raised a little bit of money, like just to keep it running. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's even sort of a more in-depth story than that, which is so I had that $27,000 pension that I knew would last us from June when I left IBM to December, 6 months.
Minus the penalties and the tax.
That's right. Then we're putting the mortgage on the credit card. Like we're putting everything on credit cards after that.
Yeah.
And so September rolls around. We've got the beta launch. There's good feedback. People are using it. Scott introduces me to some investors. I start, you know, going around Boston and talking to people. And these conversations with investors are not going well.
Yeah.
They're not going anywhere very quickly. And I remember Scott calling me on Christmas Eve of 2008 saying, hey, like, are you getting the round closed? There were a couple of angels that were the first investors in Zipcar that were going to come in. He's like, hey, are you getting the round closed? It was supposed to be $250,000.
Yep.
I said, I don't know. The money hasn't come in yet. Like, I don't know what's going on. And so in the new year, I go and sit down with the investors, and we're there with lawyers. We're supposed to be closing the round. I actually have a co-founder at the time too that's going to leave her job.
Huh.
And, you know, I've offered like 20% of the company to come on as my co-founder. So we go, we meet these investors, and they're like, listen, this financial crisis has hit us hard. We're getting cold feet. We really love what you're doing. We love the idea, but we can't,
we can't
put all this money down right now. We're just, we're nervous. And so we'll give you some money, but it's going to come in tranches. And you have to meet certain milestones to get the next check. And I am like, oh my God, it's been now 9 months since I left IBM. Everything is going on credit cards, and this round is not coming together.
Yeah.
So we leave that meeting. She decides she can't leave her full-time job to join me after all.
So you lose your co-founder.
Lose the co-founder. And the investors say, let's start with 50K. We'll give you 50K. Let's see how you do. So we start with 50K. That was March in 2009. And I just make it work. I just stretch it and keep going.
Now, how from a user's perspective at this point, it's only available in the Boston area.
Right.
Like, I have to imagine you still have a tiny number of people using it. Probably you're bringing in, I don't know, $5,000, $10,000 a month at most at that point.
Probably less, honestly.
Yeah.
Probably less. Boston was a tough market. Even at scale with TaskRabbit, Boston was like number 10 market for us.
And, I mean, you had $50,000, which is going to give you some runway, especially if it's just you pretty much doing everything.
Right.
But it's limited. You had some revenue coming in, but a really small amount. It was really mainly, sounds like you were, it was really mainly data you were collecting.
Yes, that's right. It wasn't big enough yet to sustain anything, let alone pay for the, you know, web server costs of running the site. And so I just kept expanding. At that point, though, I was working out of the Zipcar office. So Scott very nicely said, why don't you just come work out of here, you know, for as long as you want. And one day he said, you know, there's another entrepreneur from California coming by. His name's John Zimmer. He runs a company called Zimred.
Yeah.
I want you guys to meet. We're going to do a deal with them at Zipcar. I said, cool. And so later that day, I meet John, and he's like, hey, you know what? There's this incubator program Facebook is going to launch this summer. You should apply. I know the people who are going to run it. I'll put in a good word for you. And I was like, okay, great. So I go back. I tell Scott. He's like, yeah, that sounds really good. Why don't you apply to that program? And in the meantime, we had closed a little bit more angel money. You know, in total, it became around $150,000.
Yeah.
And so I apply to this program called FB Fund. I do a phone interview for it. And then we get it. We're offered it. And John says, you know what? I think it's like $250,000. Like it's a, you know, an investment from Facebook. And I say, oh, that sounds great. That sounds a great way to raise money. So we get the offer from Facebook to come out to do the incubator program. It's $15,000. And it's for a chunk of the company. It's like, you know, a few percentage points of the company.
Wow. For 15 grand.
For 15 grand. And I said, well, what happened to the 250? And they're like, yeah, well, it's different for everyone is what they tell me.
Uh-huh.
They decide how much they're going to offer you. Okay.
Right.
So I'm talking to Scott about it. He's like, don't do it. That's not worth it. It's 15 grand. Don't do it.
Yeah. And so they're offering you 15 grand, but presumably also mentorship and connections. It's Facebook.
That's right.
So what did you do?
So I decided to do it. I decided to go for it. Mm. Even though most people thought it would not be worth doing, I felt like this is the connection to Silicon Valley. There are things happening there.
Yep.
Let's go do it.
And the incubator program presumably was in California.
It was in Palo Alto. So I'd spend a week in Boston on the ground.
Yep.
And then I'd spend a week over at the Facebook program. And I told Facebook, I was like, hey, listen, like I've got this company running in Boston. I can't just go there for the summer. So I just went back and forth all summer. I mean, that was it ended up being a pivotal moment. And that program was life changing.
And I think I'm assuming if they ran it like Y Combinator and others, at a certain point, you would be able to present to investors. Is that how it worked?
Exactly. There was a big pitch day at the end of the program. And I remember on the first day of the program, one, I was surrounded by all of these other amazing entrepreneurs and founders and people. And that was the first time in my life I had been surrounded by that type of energy. And it was really exciting. So day one, they get us to stand up, introduce ourselves, and give our 30-second pitch. And it's like 20 companies. And then we get rated on how well we did on day one out of 10. I got like a 2.
They were a 2? Rated by who? By the
person
mentors?
Running the program. Yes.
Okay. Because you didn't, you didn't properly explain what you were doing or you didn't have enthusiasm? What was the feedback?
It wasn't enthusiasm. They said that I used too many technical buzzwords.
Ah, okay.
And so I really had to make the shift away from being a technical engineer and into what is the value proposition? Like, what are you actually building here for consumers?
Right.
And so that was very helpful. I mean, I actually worked on the pitch then for the next 12 weeks. And at the end, there was a big demo day. And, you know, it was online and there were investors there as well. And I was just like, I am making this round happen. Like, this is my chance. I have to bring a round together at the end of this program.
And I think what were you looking to raise? Because you hadn't really done a seed round yet, right?
No, I based on the advisors and mentors there, they said, you know, raise $1 million. Raise $1 million.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's 2009. right? And now there are people with money. There are people, there are investors. But still, even on Sand Hill Road, I mean, I've heard stories of companies looking to sell at the time for, like, pennies on the dollar that, you know, today are worth many, many tens of billions of dollars that didn't do it. But, you know, it was like a bloodbath in 2009.
Yes, it was. And I didn't fully understand yet either, you know, just how to do this or the dynamics around it. But one of the people that was very pivotal in the raise and that came out of Facebook Fund was Tim Ferriss.
Tim Ferriss.
Yes.
Who's been on the show. He's
a fabulous human being.
At the time, 4-Hour Work Week was like all, yes. Was a huge deal, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So I had read 4-Hour Work Week, and particularly as it related to runmyerrand.com, I thought, oh my God, if I could get Tim as an advisor to this company, that's going to be a huge win for us. And it just so happened that Tim was going to speak at Facebook Fund on a Monday morning. Now, I was flying back and forth, right? A week in Boston, a week in Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. So the head of the Facebook program says, okay, Monday morning, Tim Ferriss is going to be here. Surprise. What, you know, everyone can sign up for 15 minutes with Tim on Monday. I'm literally on a flight back to Boston when I get this email. I'm like, oh my God, do I really turn around just so I can have this meeting with Tim? I look online to see how much a plane ticket is to fly back. It was like $700. It was a lot. And I think, okay, it's a 15-minute meeting with Tim. Like, is this really worth it?
Yeah.
But I decide that I'm going to make it worth it. I'm going to make sure that he comes on an advisor, like whatever it takes. And so I book my ticket back on Sunday night. So I'm in Boston for a day, go back on Sunday night. And on the way there, I read the 4-Hour Work Week again. So I just have it fresh in my mind.
Yep.
I have the 15-minute meeting with Tim, and I'm showing him the site, and I'm describing Run My Errand to him, and he's giving me feedback about the homepage, and it's 15 minutes. So I'm like, oh my God, the clock is ticking down. Like, how do I ask him to be an advisor in a 15-minute meeting? So I decide that that's too much to ask for in a 15-minute meeting. All I need to do is ask for another meeting.
Yep.
And so it gets down to like 12 minutes, 13 minutes. He's giving me tons of great feedback, and I'm like, hey, you know, Tim, would you be willing to spend more time with me? Like, could we set up another meeting? And he's a little hesitant, to be honest. He's like, well, why don't you reach out to my admin and like, we'll see what we can make work. And I say, okay, great.
And it's kind of incredible because that could have been where things sort of ended. But I guess you called his assistant. You actually were able to get a lunch meeting with Tim a few days later, right?
Yes. And over that lunch meeting, we just really bond and connect over 4-Hour Work Week and Run My Errand and how they're so collaborative. And I ask him to be an advisor. And on the spot, he says yes. And he says, and I want to introduce you to my good friends that are investors, Anne Mirico at Floodgate and Steve Anderson at Baseline Ventures.
Wow.
You know, I was like, if I can turn this into a $1 million of funding, it'll be worth it.
Yeah.
And so that was just my mindset. I had to make it work.
All right. So this was a crucial meeting that you had to have. You felt like this was going to, and it did. It helped.
It
opened the doors. So you raised that $1 million, I think, by sort of the late 2009. But you're in Boston, and you're running this out of Boston. And, I mean, it sounds like Boston wasn't really, you could see that, and everyone that you talked to loved this idea, but for some reason, it wasn't really taking off like wildfire in the way you'd hoped it would.
That's right. I think the culture of Bostonians is a very do-it-yourself mentality.
Yeah.
And so that was some friction for this type of service. And I felt like if we could just get to San Francisco, where, you know, it's the tech company capital of the world, like this is the consumer market where we actually prove this is a real business.
When we come back in just a moment, Halea proves that Run My Errand is indeed a real business, but how when she's really ready to scale it, she realizes she has the wrong team at the wrong time. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This. This episode is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for building your brand, engaging your customers, and growing your business online. So if you're running a business like the founders on this show, then you'll love some of Squarespace's features. Whether you sell physical goods, digital content, or services, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online, including lots of payment options for customers at checkout, as well as easy client invoicing. Squarespace also makes email campaigns super easy with customizable email templates for converting subscribers into loyal customers. And Squarespace has tons of analytics so you know where all your site visits and sales are coming from. So check out squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/built to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. In U.S. working forests, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's the summer of 2010, and Leah and her husband Kevin decide to move to San Francisco so she can relaunch Run My Errand from there. And one of the first things she decides is to change the name of the business.
I did not like the name Run My Errand. About 20 minutes after I bought it off of GoDaddy, February of 2008. But
yep.
It did get us pretty far. It was clear. It was descriptive. I felt like what we could build was bigger than errands.
Yeah.
I felt like the word run my errand was a command and it felt demeaning. And I wanted the site and the service to feel uplifting and innovative and push the thinking forward. And so we came up with TaskRabbit.
So had you been thinking already at this point, you know, we can't just limit our brand to errands, that eventually it could be more like Angie's List, where people do repairs or where people do contracting work, or maybe it's going to be something bigger. Were you starting to think about that?
Yes. I mean, we saw the main use case was errands, but we even saw early days in Boston, people posting really interesting, different things. They needed help with a birthday party or, you know, they needed a costume sewn, or there was like all kinds of crazy things that people would come up with. And so, you know, we did a little bit of press. We did a lot of the on the ground guerrilla marketing like we had done in Boston.
And how was the response in the city?
It was much faster than it was in Boston. Hmm. And so from the very early days of launching San Francisco, I could see that just the consumer in the Bay Area was going to use the service differently. I mean, it was under a new name and brand as well, so that helped. But people were really creative with their use of the service. You know, they were using it much more often than people in Boston were. The weather was nicer, so there were a lot more outdoor tasks being done.
Yeah.
It was definitely growing faster than we were in Boston.
And at this point, I guess, you're able to hire someone who can take over the coding for you. I think this is somebody you knew from IBM, Brian Leonard. And also, I think pretty soon after you arrived to San Francisco, you started to fundraise for Series A. This was going to be big. Like this was going to be like $5 million.
That's right. It's yes. So we start to fundraise for the Series A, and Brian and I sort of hit up and down Sand Hill Road, and we pitch investors. And even given all of that, the fundraise was not easy. It wasn't easy, and we talked to a lot of investors. I remember one such meeting where we were on Sand Hill Road, Brian and I, and we park, you know, at the investor's office. And I get out of the car and I like somehow close the door awkwardly and it slams my right hand in the door. Mm. And I'm barreled over in pain. Brian is like, oh my God, are you okay? What just happened? We've got to get into this meeting. And I'm like, I'm okay. I'll deal with it later. We just go into the meeting. I walk in. I say nothing. I shake everybody's hand with my broken hand, grimacing, sit down at the table, and start the pitch. And at this point, Brian and I, you know, had done this pitch many times. Part of the pitch was also, you know, we're building out the team. Still, it's just four of us. And in this particular meeting, about halfway through, the investors interrupt us. They interrupt and they're like, hold on, hold on, hold on. Does anyone on your team speak Spanish? And I'm confused. I'm like, well, my father's Puerto Rican. I speak a little Spanish. But like, why? He's like, it just dawns on me. You could really build a huge house cleaning business with this platform. And I was like, what? What is he talking about? And he was thinking that if we spoke Spanish, we could market to the Spanish community and bring them on. It was like so far off from what we were pitching that day. And my hand is broken and I'm just completely destroyed by this meeting. So, you know, we continue to talk to investors and we finally get connected with the team over at Shasta Ventures. And then we meet Todd, who's one of the founders of Shasta. And after several meetings with them and, you know, they invite me out to dinner, which is so nice. It's very old school. I don't know if this happens anymore, but they're like, let's go out to dinner and we'll discuss terms, you know? And so then they put together a $5 million term sheet. You know, it was so exciting. It was a great interaction too. I remember Todd saying, you know, we never go back on our word. Yeah. We've never pulled back a term sheet. And like, we're really excited about working with you. And that was it. And so we decided to move forward with Shasta. And it was a great partnership with them.
Around this time, you're closing this round of financing. I think you close in 2011, May of 2011. You decide that you should not be the CEO of the company, that you should find an outside person with more experience? Tell me what you were thinking at the time.
Yeah, I was thinking, I had always wanted a business partner. I am an engineer. Yeah. That's how I was trained.
Which is really smart, by the way. It's a really smart way to think about it.
Yeah, I always wanted that business person. And so at this point, we're open in two markets. We're four people, but I know we need to raise more money. And I know that having more operational and business help is going to help get that done.
Yeah.
And so we met a lot of different people over the course of many months. We ran a whole search process.
All right. So you reach out to somebody to become the CEO. And who was it?
It's a man by the name of Eric Grossa. He was one of the early guys at Hotwire.com, $100 million business, had sold to Expedia, referenced very well, and I mean, is an amazing human being. Mm. I think when I look back, it was more about timing because the business was too early to bring in someone that was a step away from the core vision. And the business still needed me to really drive the momentum forward. He was brought in to scale.
Yeah.
It was too early to scale in the way that man can scale a company, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's brilliant.
He brought incredible businesses.
Yes.
And you guys were still just getting started.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, we did go out and raise our Series B with Eric. So Eric and I then hit the road. And I got to say, like, oh, my God, it was such a relief.
Yeah, because investors are looking at the two of you and they're saying, okay, great product, great engineer, and then super experienced operations person.
Exactly.
So here's a check.
Here's the check. And it was the largest. It was the largest round that we raised. It ended up being $18 million led by Lightspeed. It came fast because we had brought on this amazing talent.
All right. Now, meantime, there's no way that TaskRabbit is profitable because most startups are not profitable for a long time. Some are still not profitable after a very, very, very long time. But what was the business model that you start to land on at this point? Obviously, this is a question investors are asking. How are you going to make money?
So it was always just a commission from every task that went through the site. And that was always the business model. So we were always making money. And the unit economics looked good. We were profitable on a task basis. We were always making money on every task, at that point. Now, at this time, you're also starting to see Uber and Lyft and Airbnb, all these other, peer-to-peer economies really start to take off and start to emerge.
Yeah, end of 2011. Yeah.
And so we're kind of in the midst of this monumental moment for consumers.
Yeah.
And TaskRabbit actually feels pretty slow and sluggish compared to the Ubers and the Lyfts. And it's not happening as instantaneously as the consumer starts to get trained to expect.
Yeah.
And so this is the point in the business where, like, wow, we need to make instant connections, and things have to happen in real time.
But just to ask about the business model for a moment, I mean, the model of taking a commission from every task doesn't seem to me to be sustainable in the long run, because you would have to have hundreds of thousands of tasks happening every day to hit profitability. Because if it's like, I don't know, $40, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like there had to be other revenue streams that you had to focus on. Is that right? Did that happen?
You know, the main revenue stream was the commissions, and the average task size at that time was about $150.
Okay, right.
And so the numbers worked. We took anywhere between 20 and 30% of a task, and that was, net profit to us.
Right.
So, yeah, that was always the main business model.
All right. Now, Eric was brought in to really scale the company. You had now a pretty nice war chest.
Yes.
But you were in the process of trying to scale. It sounds like the adoption rate wasn't moving as quickly as you'd hoped.
Yeah, that's right. Because it never really felt like a rocket ship. It always felt like we were on the brink of getting on the rocket ship, right?
Yeah.
And so the lever in the model was always this repeat usage metric. Like, if you could get someone to post 2 tasks a month or 1 time a week, that was the huge lever in the model that, like, really made all the numbers work. But on average, people were posting about 1 time a month at the time. And so we're like, okay, why is it only happening 1 time a month? Where is the friction in the model?
Yeah.
At the same time, Eric is really, like, he's starting to scale the company the way he knows how to scale companies. It's like, bring on sales and marketing and, I need more engineering. We need business development people. We need operation. Like, so we're scaling up, and we're also realizing that the product now in 2011 is just not working.
Wow.
And at this point, there are competitors coming out that are launching mobile first, mobile only. And we've been on the web. Like, we have a mobile product, but it hasn't been given a lot of attention because we've been so focused on the web. I mean, honestly, it's like the entire consumer market and expectation just changed underneath us, and we missed it.
I think Eric would end up being CEO for like less than a year before you kind of took reassume that role. Can you tell me what happened ultimately? Because it doesn't sound like it was like dragged down, I hate you, I hate you.
No, not
it was
at
just
all.
The wrong fit.
It was the wrong timing, and it was the wrong fit. And it turned out that we needed to really change the trajectory of the product into this mobile first, fast paced, on demand service, which was more analogous to Uber and Lyft and all these other services and all these other competitors, frankly, that were popping up. But we had scaled a team that was built to run a traditional web business.
Yeah.
And so we decided as a board, that I would step back in and become CEO again. It was slightly reluctantly. I mean, I really felt like I had failed. I mean, that this process had failed, right? I mean, I I wanted help. I wanted a business person.
Yeah.
And that didn't work. And now I have to step back in. And I also need to like change the trajectory of this giant ship that's going in the wrong direction.
Were you worried about your burn rate?
Extremely worried about the burn rate. I mean, at that point, I think we were burning probably over $1 million a month.
And you had money in the bank, but still.
We did. We had over $20 million in the bank. I remember, you know, so it was kind of like, okay, you've got a lot of funding, but the burn is high. We've hired a lot of people. And we've also built a team that may not be the right team to execute what we need to do next.
All right. In the middle of 2013, you had to lay off about 30% of the team. You restructured the company. Tell me what you were thinking of in the summer of 2013.
Yes. So it ended up being about 20% of the team.
How many people? Do you remember?
At that point, we were probably 80 people. And so it was under 20 people that we transitioned out. I had to look them in the eye and say, you know, this isn't working anymore, and we've got to move on. At the time, I was 6 months pregnant with my first baby, Amelia, and I remember going into the office that morning just feeling totally sick to my stomach. You know, I deliver the news to this group of people, you know, in segments and chunks. And we had enough money in the bank to really make sure that we took care of them financially. So that was important. But it was going to be a huge morale hit. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, this is my first pregnancy. And I'm nervous because I feel like, you know what? I haven't felt the baby move today. And it's just a lot of stress. And like, maybe it's okay. But like, oh. I don't know. And so I call my doctor in the afternoon, and she's like, I need you to come in. So I go in, they monitor. The baby's sluggish. She's like, no, this isn't in your head. You're not making this up. Wow. Like, are you under a lot of stress? I'm like, oh my God, am I under a lot of stress?
Yeah.
And, you know, it turned out everything was
yes,
okay.
Thank you. Please, let's get to the end of that story.
Everything's
everything was
okay.
Fine.
Baby's okay. Amelia's 9 now. She was okay.
Yeah.
But it was just like my body was reacting to the amount of stress I was under.
Yeah.
And, you know, my doctor said to me, she said, listen, I told her what had happened. And I'm like crying. You know, she's like, listen, you're not going to kill your baby. She said that out to me flat. You're not going to kill your baby with stress. I was like, okay, all right. And I was kind of, all right, that's what I needed to hear because I need to go back and take care of some things too. But, you know, she monitored me for a few hours. I came back to the office. Like, things were settled down. You know, and we moved forward. We all moved forward.
All right. Meantime, so you've got... There's just a lot going on, right? You also realize that the model you have, which is kind of like this bidding system or the Book Now system, it was confusing. There were people who liked it because they could, you know, haggle over a price, and even some of the TaskRabbit, what were they called? The errand runners?
Taskers.
The Taskers, yeah. Like some of them liked it, but you knew that there was too much friction with this model, that it wasn't easy to get. And I remember this. I remember going on TaskRabbit in like 2013 and being like, this is confusing.
Yep.
It's like, I don't want to bid. I'm not good at haggling. Like, I just tell me the price.
Yes.
And so you really, the team started to come up with a completely new model that you guys called it the Booker T model, I guess, after like Bookers and the Model T. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. And this was an idea that came out of the product team.
And what was going to be different? It was going to just be like, here's a price and here's how it works?
It was going to be a direct booking platform. And what we needed to do was remove more friction from the bidding. So we got rid of bidding, you know, and so people could just post, I want to pay this much money, and then Taskers would take it or leave. You know, there wasn't a lot of back and forth. So that helped.
And when you introduced this, from what I understand, you actually started in London, in the UK, to test it out.
Yes.
But when you brought it to the US, like, I think there was a pretty strong minority of users, maybe strong and vocal minority of people who hated it.
It was a very loud minority.
Yeah. And they really hated it.
Yes.
And what did they say?
Oh, my God. This was so hard because millions of people were using TaskRabbit in the US. And thank God we launched this new product in London because we saw it work. We saw the mobile product work, this on-demand booking platform. It worked. The metrics doubled, the repeat usage. And we're like, okay, this works. Now we need to take 1 million people in the US and 60,000 taskers that are on the platform, and we need to transition them to a completely new way of working. We actually brought a tasker from London, from the UK, who is operating in the London market, and we had her train taskers in the US, city by city, in these little community gatherings. Thank God we launched that London product, because if we hadn't, we would have been completely overwhelmed by that vocal minority. And we could have pulled back. We could have completely decided not to move forward just based on the feedback because it was so visceral.
Yeah.
But we saw it working. We knew it was going to work.
Where did you see what was the most popular task? Was it IKEA furniture building?
Literally since day one, IKEA furniture assembly was always
one.
It was always in the top five tasks, and it number one all the time.
TaskRabbit, it became, in my mind, I remember, it was like, oh, you just get a TaskRabbit person to do it if you don't have time.
Yes.
I remember people saying that in like 2014, 15. I remember having those conversations.
It was always IKEA Furniture Assembly. And it was so funny because it took years and years to make contact with them. And, you know, finally we did, obviously. But that was great for us. That was great.
And meanwhile, you guys actually start to become profitable around this period, and you also start to have conversations with IKEA. I mean, and you knew that tons of people were coming to TaskRabbit to get their IKEA furniture built, so it was like a match made in heaven. So initially, when IKEA started to talk to you guys, was it talking about a potential acquisition, or did it start with like a partnership conversation?
It started with a partnership conversation, and they knew that we were live in London, and London is one of their biggest markets. And London for us was number four out of all the markets we were launched in. So we were doing very well in London.
Yeah.
And they wanted to talk about a partnership in store so that they could drive up sales, right, and have people buy more IKEA furniture because it would then be assembled by a TaskRabbit.
And so initially it was, let's have some kind of partnership.
Yeah, and it was great. So we launched in the London market a partnership between IKEA and TaskRabbit. And what I really got excited about with IKEA is particularly being in their headquarters, you could feel that they had similar values around sustainability and culture, just their way of thinking about the business. It felt really aligned with TaskRabbit. And that got me really excited about working with them.
All right. So IKEA acquires TaskRabbit in 2017. And not long after you leave, you step away from the company.
Yes.
Do you feel, you're 5 years plus removed from TaskRabbit now. Do you have any emotional attachment to it or not anymore?
Oh, God. I do. It's... So as a founder, I always felt like, wouldn't it be amazing to build something that lives beyond you? And that's what I got to achieve. And that was incredible. Now, the flip side of that is there's this company that lives beyond me that I have no control over anymore. But everybody associates with me. And so sometimes I'm on the opposite end where people are like asking me questions about like, oh, and, you know, what do you think about this with TaskRabbit? And what do you think about this decision or that? And I'm just like, wow, I have no input. No, I'm very detached, I know a handful of people at that company today. So it is sort of odd for me because it was my baby. It is my baby. It was the first baby. And so it is this very conflicting feeling at times. I'm proud that it lives on beyond me. And I also sometimes feel a conflict that I'm no longer a part of it.
Yeah. I mean, it is an amazing story. Like, you started this in an apartment in Charlestown, Boston, and did everything. I mean, you built the site and all the functions and features, and you recruited the users, and you recruited the taskers, and you formed the LLC, and you did it for a year and a half before you hired somebody. I mean, that's amazing. And that's, I mean, and then you built a brand that people know. They know that name.
Yeah. I mean, looking back, it was a lot. And could I go back and do it all again? Oh my God, I don't know. Could I go back and even do that whole product pivot change in 2014? I don't know. But I'm really, really glad that I did when I did. I'm proud of the journey that I had, that we had. But it was a lot.
Do you, when you think about, you know, what happened with TaskRabbit and your and everything that you created and built, obviously with great smart collaborators, do you think that what you achieved there was because you worked really hard, or do you think there was luck involved too?
I think it's definitely both. I think that there are definitely times that through circumstance I was very lucky. For instance, being able to be out to dinner and get connected with Scott Griffith from an old coworker. Like, you can't plan some of these things to happen. There was a lot of serendipity. And I think at the same time, given the serendipity, you have to be able to capture it and execute on it.
Yeah.
And so for me, I feel like it was very much both. It was both.
That's Leah Sullivan, founder of TaskRabbit. Right now, Leah is helping lead an early-stage venture capital firm called Fuel Capital. By the way, she and her former husband, Kevin, divorced a few years after the sale to IKEA, but they still remain friends, and Leah is now remarried. And from time to time, she still hires taskers. In fact, a while back, after TaskRabbit went fully remote, Leah heard that they had to get rid of the 8-foot wooden logo that used to hang outside the office. She hated to think of someone throwing it out, so she hired a tasker to deliver it to her house, and it now sits in her garage. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you want to contact the team, our email address is hibt@id.wondery.com. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, our account is @HowIBuiltThis, and mine is @GuyRaz. On Instagram, we're @HowIBuiltThis, and I'm @Guy.Raz. This episode was produced by Kerry Thompson with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. It was edited by Neva Grant with research help from Sam Paulson. Our production staff also includes J.C. Howard, Casey Herman, Liz Metzger, Alex Chung, Josh Lash, Catherine Seifer, Elaine Coates, Chris Messini, Carla Estevez, and John Isabella. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey. It's so important to give children gifts that inspire them to learn more about topics they love. And that's why I love KiwiCo. With super fun science, technology, and art projects, KiwiCo is perfect for inspiring creative confidence and a lifelong love of learning. I've used KiwiCo with my kids for many, many years now, and it's been amazing to see how they've built these really sophisticated engineering projects that have been designed specifically for their age ranges. KiwiCo projects are designed by a team of educators, makers, engineers, and rocket scientists who brainstorm hundreds of ideas to create the most exciting, age-appropriate, and educational projects. And the projects are tested and approved by kids. No crate leaves without their thumbs up. Discover hands-on fun with KiwiCo. Get your first month free on any crate line at kiwico.com/built. That's your first month free at kiwico.com/built.